The Lighthouse Report's investigation, Big Food versus the People, has 234 points and 149 comments. And it's the kind of long-form investigative journalism that HN occasionally surfaces and that deserves more attention than the score suggests. The investigation documents the lobbying strategies that major food companies use to weaken nutrition labeling requirements, delay front-of-pack warning labels, and undermine public health guidelines, not just in the U.S., but across multiple countries simultaneously.
The international dimension is what makes this particularly disturbing. When a country tries to implement warning labels, Chile and Mexico have done this. The EU is working toward it. Food industry groups mount coordinated opposition that often includes trade complaints under international agreements. There's a documented playbook. Fund industry-aligned research to create uncertainty about the science. Lobby trade bodies to frame labeling as a technical barrier to trade. And use bilateral investment treaty mechanisms to threaten governments with arbitration costs. It's sophisticated, patient, and effective.
This is where the antitrust and regulatory framework question becomes relevant. The food industry's behavior here is legal. Lobbying is legal. Funding research is legal. Filing trade complaints is legal. But the aggregate effect is that regulatory capture operates at a scale that individual competitive markets can't address. Which brings up a question the HN community is debating in that thread. What would actually change this?
Marcus, since you've been tracking the regulatory space, this feels like a good moment for the curriculum corner. Because some of the HN comments are conflating antitrust concerns with what are really consumer protection issues and their distinct legal frameworks.
That's exactly the right observation. Antitrust law and consumer protection law are different tools. Antitrust in the U.S. is primarily governed by the Sherman Act of 1890, and the core prohibition is on monopolization and on agreements that restrain trade. But here's the thing people often misunderstand. Having a large market share is not by itself illegal. A company can have 80% of a market and be perfectly legal under antitrust law. What the Sherman Act prohibits is using anti-competitive conduct to acquire or maintain that position. Predatory pricing designed to destroy competitors, exclusive dealing arrangements that lock out rivals, tying arrangements that force customers to buy products they wouldn't otherwise choose.
The analogy I find useful. Think of antitrust law like the rules of a race. The Sherman Act doesn't say you can't win. It says you can't trip the other runners or bribe the officials to move the finish line. A company that wins by being genuinely better at what it does has a legal monopoly. A company that wins by systematically destroying rivals through conduct that has no business justification other than eliminating competition is violating Section 2.
And the food industry's lobbying behavior, as documented in the Lighthouse Report's piece, doesn't really fit the Sherman Act framework because it's not about market dominance in the economic sense, it's about regulatory influence. That's a different problem requiring different solutions, which is probably why the policy discussion in those HN comments keeps going in circles.
The $120,000 per gallon water story has 198 points and 151 comments. And the detail that's most striking is that this isn't about bottled water or mineral water. It's about certified reference standard water used in laboratory calibration and metrology. The reason it costs that much is the extraordinary process required to establish certification. The water has to be verified to contain specific isotopic ratios. The certification process involves multiple national metrology institutes, and the chain of custody documentation is as rigorous as anything in pharmaceutical manufacturing.
The HN thread apparently becomes a fascinating discussion about how certification itself creates value that's entirely divorced from the physical substance being certified. The water isn't expensive because water is scarce. It's expensive because knowing precisely what's in it, documented to an internationally recognized standard, is expensive. That's a general principle with broad applications. A lot of what we pay for in regulated industries is the documentation and verification infrastructure, not the underlying physical good.
The tiny holdout building inside Macy's is my favorite story of the week for sheer weirdness. For over 100 years, a small building on 34th Street in Manhattan was concealed by Macy's billboards and signage. Macy's couldn't buy it, so they built around it and covered it up. The owner of the building reportedly refused to sell, and rather than demolish the adjacent structure, Macy's just hid it. The billboards are apparently coming down, revealing this genuinely strange piece of urban history. The HN comments unsurprisingly spiral into a discussion of property rights, urban planning, and other famous holdout cases.
Holdout buildings are a real phenomenon in real estate economics. The last property in a development site has enormous leverage because the developer needs exactly that parcel to complete the project. The value of that property to the developer can be orders of magnitude higher than its market value, which is why developers typically try to assemble land parcels under non-disclosure or option agreements before revealing the project. Macy's apparently failed to do that, or the owner figured it out, and the result was a 100-year standoff embedded in one of the most valuable retail districts in the world.
Before we close this segment, I want to do the What If We're Wrong exercise on what I think is the episode's most confident technical claim, the Google Chrome AI bug fixing numbers. The claim is that AI fixed more Chrome security bugs in June 2026 than in the entire preceding 2 years. The HN community's bullish interpretation is that AI is now genuinely production capable at security engineering tasks. What's the strongest argument that we're reading this wrong?
The strongest challenge is about what we mean by bugs fixed. Security vulnerabilities in software aren't a uniform category. There's an enormous difference between a use after free vulnerability in a memory allocator that could allow remote code execution and a cross-site scripting issue in a rarely used feature. If AI is very good at finding and fixing the latter category, and humans were previously spending their time on the former, the absolute count of bugs fixed could increase dramatically, while the actual security risk reduction is much more modest.
And there's a related concern about what AI tools do to the discovery to fix pipeline. If AI can find bugs much faster than it can verify that the fixes are correct, you might end up with a situation where the rate of introducing subtle fix bugs also increases. Security engineering has a long history of patches that introduced new vulnerabilities in the process of closing old ones. A human security engineer reviews a fix with the question, could this itself be exploited? Does an AI-generated fix get that same scrutiny before it ships?
What would tell us we're wrong about this being a genuine capability improvement rather than a reporting artifact? I'd watch for three things. Independent security researchers who audit AI-generated patches and find elevated rates of subtle errors, an increase in regression-type vulnerabilities in Chrome over the next 6 months that trace back to AI-generated fixes, and whether Google starts publishing the methodology in enough detail that it can be externally replicated. Right now, we have one data point from the party with the most incentive to present it favorably.
That's not a reason to dismiss the claim. It's a reason to hold it provisionally while watching for confirming or disconfirming evidence. The base claim could still be true and important, even if the full picture is more complicated than the headline suggests.